And to begin with a short poem by Li Po, a great Chinese master. He said, "The birds have vanished into the sky, and now the last cloud fades away. We sit together, the mountain and I, until only the mountain remains." This theme is about the search for oneness, which is a theme that really, we might say, runs through all of our lives. Certainly one of the greatest sources of pain as a human being is the painfulness of feeling separate, apart, feeling disconnected from others or from ourselves, feeling distant. That sense of separateness is certainly the root of many other feelings of loneliness, of alienation, of self-consciousness, often leading us to feel fearful of the world or anxious. This isolation of feeling adrift, of not being related, is that sense of homelessness. We can feel homeless within ourselves and homeless within the world. Now, much of our lives actually is spent seeking an end to the painfulness of separation. Many of the choices we make in our lives, many of the relationships we form, coming to meditation practice, so many of the things that we do are really concerned with finding a way to end separation through discovering oneness, through discovering relatedness, through discovering intimacy, through discovering depth with other people, with life, with ourselves, with the moment. One of the greatest sources of joy as a human being is to actually find those glimpses of oneness. When separateness fades away, and where it is replaced by deep sense of connectedness, of being at home, of being intimate. Now, these glimpses we find many times in our lives. Sometimes we find these glimpses in nature. Sometimes we find these glimpses of oneness with other people. Sometimes we find them with ourselves. In those moments when that sense of oneness is present, I think there's a very genuine sense that whatever is happening in that moment is enough, that there's nothing missing, nothing to be added, nothing that would make that moment more complete. Now, those glimpses of oneness don't have to happen through some really very, very special experience. We can sit outside here and find a moment when suddenly a lot drops away. A lot of thinking, a lot of struggling, a lot of analyzing. And that sense of really resting totally within the sights and the sounds and the touches of that moment. But those moments are often so profound in our lives when they do touch us that they inspire us. And they perhaps inspire us to look for a more enduring, a deeper sense of oneness. In a very real way, meditation does reflect this search for oneness that goes on elsewhere in our lives. We might say that in meditation practice, there are almost two dimensions. Two dimensions, which sounds strange, two dimensions of oneness that are stressed. One dimension of that is born of developing clear, wise, wholehearted attentiveness of being present. It is really a sense of oneness that can come through concentration. The other dimension of oneness or non-separateness is a very profound level of non-separateness that is born of insight and understanding. Now, the dimension of oneness that is really born of concentration, we relearn, we rediscover how to be wholeheartedly attentive. The liberating understanding of non-separateness that's born of wisdom emerges from the dropping away of delusion and misunderstanding. They're not the same. The kind of oneness that can come through concentration is actually not the same as the dimension of oneness that really comes through wisdom. Now, I don't think that anyone would ever say that concentration is liberating. No one would even say that concentration is a necessary prerequisite to profound understanding. But neither is concentration and wisdom entirely unrelated. They do have a relationship. As I mentioned earlier on in the retreat, the Buddha once linked these together by saying that upon goodness of heart is built wise attention. Upon wise attention is built liberating insight. In all of the kind of teaching, certainly within the Buddhist tradition, in most meditative traditions I've ever come across, there is stressed over and over again the need to pay attention, the need to be here, if we're going to understand anything at all. And stressing the relationship between clear attention and deep understanding. In one of the suttas in the Buddhist teaching, the Buddha talks about four kinds of people. You may have guessed by now, Buddhism is incredible at making lists. You know, it's got a list for everything. Anyway, here comes another four kinds of people, different than the three kinds of people I mentioned yesterday. These four kinds of people, the Buddha said, there is the kind of person who's really well-developed, both in concentration and in insight, and their path is one of simply deepening in both. He said there's the kind of person who's really well developed in concentration but has very little insight, and that their practice is to sustain the concentration and develop the insight. He said there's a kind of person who's really lots of insight and not too much concentration, and their path is to deepen the concentration and sustain the insight. And then there's the kind of person who's not that well developed in either. And that their path is actually very clear. They have quite a bit to do here. I would like to look at some of the parallels that do exist between the sense of oneness that's developed through attentiveness and the sense of oneness where there's a deeper understanding of non-separateness. Now, both of these dimensions of oneness actually involve a lot of dropping away. Oneness, it seems, involves a lot of falling away of fragmentation, falling away of distractedness, falling away of resistance. Both involve wholeheartedness, really so wholeheartedly, passionately present in the moment. Now, in meditation practice, in the meditation practices we've been doing here, what we really cultivate and develop is wise attention. That's actually what we're training in, developing in, is wise attention. It's the process in which we learn to come ever closer to the moment, learn to see things as they are, learn to rest in a great simplicity without adding anything or taking anything away from the moment. So when we breathe, we just breathe. When we listen, we just listen. When we walk, we just walk. Now, in that wholehearted consciousness and simplicity, what there is a falling away of is a falling away of the world of associations and stories and preferences and likes and dislikes. I have another arrow story for you. Obviously, these were very popular too. There's a story in the Buddha's teaching about a man who, another man who gets shot by an arrow. Right, and so all of these people come to his assistance and they want to take the arrow out. They want to ease his pain. And as they come closer to help him, he says, hold on just a minute. Before you touch that arrow, I want to know what kind of wood it's made of, what direction it was fired from, how fast it was fired, the person who fired it, why they did it, why I deserved it, what part of my anatomy is damaged, and the list went on and on and on and on. Obviously, the great moral of this story is that it would have been simpler just to take the arrow out, which is basically what we learn to do in practice. We learn to let go or let fall away as much as we can of this personal world of busyness and complexity. Now, this quality of wholehearted attentiveness is something that develops. We train it, we nurture it, and it deepens with practice. And it does rest upon a number of different factors. It rests upon wise effort. It rests upon a sense of willingness. It rests upon clear intention. And it does work. When all of those factors are there, what happens is that the mind and body do come to a greater place of calmness, stillness, and well-being. These are all a practice of attention, which is essentially a practice that brings us closer to the moment, lessens distance, and lessens disconnection. It cuts through the forces that separate us from ourselves and from what is. Now, some people have some resistance to cultivating this kind of concentration or wise attention. Some people might be tempted to say, well, that's just concentration, you know, and really I'm into a higher path of insight. Sometimes the resistance becomes developing attention, in case you hadn't noticed by now, actually is really hard work. It requires a lot of effort and dedication and energy. And the truth is that most of us are pretty well served. Our lives are actually, and mind and body is actually quite enriched by having some clear access to some steady, wise attentiveness in our lives. Now, as I also mentioned earlier on, it is true that, you know, if you don't have any attention, you probably, of course you'll still have insights and you'll still have understanding in your lives. But often what is also true is that understanding can stay on a level just of thinking that doesn't have so much transforming power. And then, of course, we experience frustration. And people have talked about it here, the frustration of knowing how they get into trouble, knowing how they engage in patterns of suffering, and yet not being able to change it. You've probably heard that line that ignorance is bliss. I think that line was invented by people who had a lot of insight and not enough attention to actually have that insight transform anything at all. Because there's an incredible amount of frustration of, you know, standing back and saying, oh, you know, being judgmental makes me unhappy. There I am being judgmental again, you know, makes me unhappy again. There's that incredible frustration of being caught up in those cycles. Sometimes when we're caught up in them, we feel to be a captive of our own habits of causing suffering. And what are those habits? Of obsessing and dwelling and liking and disliking. Is there a lack of insight in those moments? No. But sometimes what happens is that there's just not enough stillness. not enough presence, not enough calmness for the insight to really penetrate to a cellular level where it actually transforms us. Now, this is the place of wise attention. It doesn't necessarily enlighten us, but it provides an environment inwardly of calmness and happiness and well-being in which we can be touched deeply by understanding, where we uproot the habits of confusion. Wise attention is an antidote. It's a cure, a healer of fragmentation and busyness, of that sense of being lost and divided. So what is fragmentation? What is fragmentation? It's the way that we can feel so adrift and so lost in the swirl of thinking, the way that we get so lost in our stories. And I'll tell you a little story now. Many years ago, when I first started teaching, one of the first places I taught was Australia in the rainforest. And I just lived in India for 5 years, and I thought I was a pretty hardy kind of, you know, tough kind of person. I mean, to live in India for 5 years, you got to have something going for you, right? So I went to Australia, to the rainforest, figured this is going to be fine. I totally underestimated the Australians. They got some hardy folks out there who live in the rainforest. Anyway, in the rainforest, there was every kind of wildlife you can imagine. I'd never seen most of it before. You know, 15-foot-long pythons, you know, these kind of lizards that crawled up trees that looked like alligators. You know, things that jumped out of bushes and started eating, you know, leeches that stuck on your face everywhere you went. Anyway, I found all this a little surprising, and everybody told me, none of this hurts you, this is all quite harmless. They said, that's a lizard. To me, it looked like an alligator. They could tell me it was a lizard all day long, and I was still going to think it was an alligator. Walking to the meditation room one day, there was a python hanging down off the tree in front of the door to the meditation room, swinging back and forth like a pendulum, very happily swallowing a possum. You know, and to go into the meditation room, you had to stand until the python swung that way and someone would come in. We'd swing back, you'd wait again the next present day. Still, they told me, this is totally a friendly environment. My thought was, these people are deluded. This is not a friendly environment. Anyway, being a meditation teacher full of equanimity, of course, I never said a word, but this was a very rustic meditation center. There were no doors. That was a part of being rustic. There were no doors. So I had this little, they called it a kuti, I called it a shack in the forest, with no doors and no electricity. So you can imagine when night fell, you'd go to bed, and through this shack would come this procession of wildlife all night long, you know. And having seen it during the day, I was not reassured. You know, I had no idea what was going to climb into my bed. So, of course, you can imagine this is a very fertile environment for quite a few stories to arise. You know, a lot of stories, actually, would arise. And, in fact, so many stories that I used to have a pile of ammunition beside my bed, you know, books and shoes and every time some creature came in, I'd throw something. And usually what would happen after a night or two, of course, not sleeping at all, I discovered I could turn on a flashlight and illuminate whatever came into my house at night. You know? And actually, I found that in doing that, the stories fell away because I also had a back door, which was really lucky. So it would these things would come in the front door, you know, wild pigs, lizards, that kind of stuff.
And they just walk right through. You know, this was... I mean, they really weren't interested in me at all, you know. So, you know, the stories fell away. If you get the moral of this story, you shine the light and the stories fall away. These things just walk right through. This is what wise attention does. We shine the light and things walk right through. And it's a way of letting go of some of that tangle of likes and dislikes and preferences and should and shouldn't. You know, there's that very wonderful line that says, the great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. It's not. And that's where we're going towards, of being able to accommodate all things. What wise attention does is it cuts through the habit of departing from what is. It cuts through the habit of creating separation and distance. You know, every time you return in this practice, you return to the moment, you return over and over. It's not because we think there's something special about being a perfect breather, but what we do in that returning over and over is in the service of oneness. Every time we do that, we are learning this incredible art of letting go. We are letting go. Every time we begin again, we are letting go of fragmentation, we're letting go of distance, we're letting go of dwelling and interpretation. We learn to cultivate one wholehearted moment. One wholehearted moment. It sounds so easy, and it is so challenging. And in that, we are cultivating the factor of oneness. In the field of attention, which is a very big field, I hope you appreciate that during this retreat, you've had a kind of bus tour through the dimensions of Vipassana. You know, we've kind of checked out the whole dimensions. I would mention that within these various areas that we focused and explored, there is a way of undertaking all of those areas as a very sustained and deep practice. One of those areas is developing a very deep level of concentration. Now, in developing a very deep level of attention, there are five factors of absorption that are said to be important. The first is applied attention. The second is sustained attention. The third is rapture. The fourth is happiness. And the fifth is oneness or absorption. Now, the first of applied attention, that's what we do here. We apply our attention to our breathing, to the moment. It's where we all start. With the intention to be attentive. Now, the intention to be attentive, of course, is very different than the kind of attention that is just captured by whatever is most strong or powerful in the moment. It's an intentional attention. We apply our attention to the breath, to a sound, to a sensation, to a feeling. And that applying attention brings us closer to all of that. It lessens distance. What we do see is how difficult it is to do that. How reluctant our attention seems to be to rest with ease in one moment at a time. We start out with good intentions, right? Probably all of you find this. You start a sitting really good intention to be with the breath. 5 minutes later, you lose interest. Or your attention gets hijacked by something else, some other event that's happening in the moment. Or a hindrance runs in and you're lost again. Or we get lost in our reactions to what's happening. We say, I don't like this, we should have more of this, less of that. We catch glimpses of the breath, but often it seems like there's so much that gets in the way. You know, even the thoughts, am I breathing right? Am I breathing wrong? It's boring. You know, that's just like I breathed last time. You know, why isn't it different? We draw our attention to a thought and it jumps away again and the next thought comes in. Now, initially, we can feel like all of these things that jump in, you know, the thoughts or the hindrances, we feel sometimes like there's something we have to get rid of. We maybe react against them, or we feel like, you know, we're going to really get this stuff right once we've got managed to get rid of all this stuff. So in a little while, so sometimes we kind of resist or blame or struggle. And then we realize that we actually have to include all those things. That we have to learn how to include sensations, thoughts, hindrances within the field of our attention. That most often in this practice, the things we call a distraction are the things we feel we can't welcome. So we try and push them away. More and more we begin to understand that a cultivation of oneness must be at one with all things. That doesn't mean lost or submerged, but it does mean giving attention. As Dogen once said, there is nothing that is not practiced by those inspired by the truth. When skilled in living this way, there is nothing without value, including the hindrances, including the thoughts. As we learn to cultivate a more friendly environment to everything that arises, what happens is that our attentiveness becomes more natural. And we move from this place of applied attention to sustained attention, where there's a very natural bond between the attentiveness and its object. It's that place where the attention just rests so easily in the breathing and the breath just breathes itself. Occasional thoughts arise, not a problem. Occasional sensations arise, not a problem. But there's that sense of great ease. And what arises out of that is the next factor of rapture. And this is one of the parts of concentration practice is rapture. You know, and I personally believe everybody deserves a little rapture in this life, you know. Practicing, moving into sustained attention, there does arise the factors of bliss, rapture, which eventually actually quietens into happiness, a deep sense of happiness where the body dissolves, the mind is fully focused in attentiveness, and that moves into oneness, where the attention is absorbed into itself. Now, I hope you realize I don't tell you these things in order to depress you or fill you with ambitiousness or say, oh, well, I haven't got any of that yet, you know. But to realize that this practice of concentration has extraordinarily profound benefits. And within them, there is the enduring theme of oneness and happiness. Now, these states of concentration, I will go on to say, they are temporary. They are temporary. They are dependent upon the factors of energy, of effort, of perseverance. So sometimes we think, oh, temporary, well, maybe they're not worth the effort. However, even though those states of concentration are temporary, there are within them a number of insights which are quite transforming. And I'd like to talk about just a little bit about some of the benefits of concentration. One of the benefits, first of all, is happiness. So developing very deep levels of attentiveness, one discovers within oneself a very deep, profound sense of joy and happiness, which is not dependent upon anything that is received through the sense doors. It's not dependent on getting anything at all from the world. It is an inner happiness that saturates the mind and body. And you know there's a very deep insight that is intrinsic to discovering that inner happiness. We really understand so deeply that there is nothing that we can gain, nothing that we can achieve, nothing that we can possess, no pleasant state that can be grasped hold of that can ever, ever compare in depth with this quality of inner joy that arises within ourselves. Now, the implications of seeing that quality of happiness is that it really changes our relationship to the world. It really lessens the tendency or the inclination towards both grasping and aversion. It really uproots the inclination of believing that I need to get rid of something or to get something in order to be happy. There is truly the understanding that that happiness lies within our own being. One of the other benefits of this depth of concentration is, of course, the discovery of a great stillness inwardly and a love of being present. And the insight that comes from that is that the mind actually loses its addiction to busyness. It loses its infatuation with fantasy, with anxiety, with worry, and through dwelling. They fade away. One of the lasting benefits of concentration practices is that you don't know how to be anxious anymore. It's not bad, is it? The other benefit is that the capacity to think clearly and to think creatively is greatly enhanced, so that the mind actually becomes a great friend. The mind actually becomes a great ally, and there comes with that such a profound level of trust and confidence in our own being, something that can never be taken away and never shattered. Attention, this practice of attention, is sometimes called a purification practice. And the way this word purification is not used in the way of sensible, I become so pure or holy. The purification practice is that this quality of wise attention really opens the doors that allows many of our demons, many of our shadows, many of our deeply held areas of contractedness to arise into consciousness, but also to be met with the equanimity and the balance and the steadiness that allows them to be let go of. This attention allows us to penetrate deeply. It gives us a real taste of oneness, where the breather is absorbed into the breath, the listener is absorbed into the sound, the walker is absorbed into the walking. There's a taste of oneness, a real taste of oneness. And it's a kind of a glimpse of the very profound understanding of oneness that is really born through understanding non-separateness, where there is never any sense of two or any sense of merging. To reflect a little bit upon this feeling of separation, this feeling of separateness that can exist between ourselves and others, between ourselves and ourselves, between ourselves and the world. In Dharma teaching, this belief in separation is said to be rooted in misunderstanding or in delusion. That through misunderstanding, we come to believe that we are an isolated self, separate and apart and independent of all other selves. We come to believe that we are an isolated self in a changing world of people and objects and phenomena. When we are entrenched in this belief in a separate self, it makes everything and everyone else into other, something other, apart from ourselves. We can believe ourselves to be a separate self living in a world of many selves, and this is actually a scary way to live. This is a frightening way to live. It's certainly the fertile ground for a great deal of craving and aversion and alienation. The Christian mystic once said that anxiety is the mood of ignorance, that anxiety is the mood of separateness. And of course, there is anxiety living in a world where we see ourselves on some level as being separate from everything around us. There's the fear of loss, the fear of being without, the fear of being harmed. And sometimes those fears and anxieties, they make us want to hold on to and to grasp hold of things even more tightly. Do you notice that whenever you feel anxious or uncertain, that you want to grasp hold of whatever feels certain even more strongly, whether it's another person or our health or our identity or our role? When we feel anxious, how often we find ourselves grasping and holding more and more strongly. Anxiety is a messenger. I often think of fear as being a kind of messenger in our lives, not telling us to grasp more strongly, but inviting us to question whether this sense of separateness is actually true. To question whether that is actually true. Often we find it difficult to come to that question because we're so busy trying to cover up or camouflage or get away from the anxieties that come to us. If you notice the inclination towards holding on to things here, you know, how a thought comes, you grasp hold of it. A sensation comes, we can grasp hold of it. A feeling comes, we can grasp hold of it. A sound comes, we grasp hold of it. You've probably noticed that that's not always a particularly pleasant experience, that it does lead to a feeling of being stuck or lost or powerless. What we often are doing, more unconsciously, I think, when we're grasping, is that we're trying to kind of find a sort of unreal sense of oneness. You know, we hold on to a thought or to a person or to our bodies, and we say, this is mine. This is mine. And we almost try and submerge ourselves in it. And in that, there's a kind of seeking for oneness. But what we surrender, of course, in that activity of grasping and holding, what we surrender is reality. Because you may have noticed, what is reality doing? It's changing. It's arising and passing. It's appearing and disappearing. Things do that on a moment-to-moment level. This is really bad news for grasping. It's really bad news for grasping. You notice how slippery something is when you try and grasp hold of it, desperately wanting it to stay the same. And it moves, it shifts. Where is that thought we cherished at breakfast time? You know, where is that insight we wanted to hold on to forever? Goes. That change is really bad news for grasping, but reality is actually not bad news. What it teaches us is that we really can't hold on to anything at all. Now, what would our lives look like if we really appreciated that? That I can't hold on to anything at all. We have a kind of painful dilemma. We often try to grasp hold of things in order to relieve feelings of suffering or isolation or anxiety. Yet grasping intrinsically is ineffective because nothing at all can be grasped. If nothing at all is willing to stand still for us, this is really good for us to see. Because it's an understanding that finally allows us to step back a little bit and to question the root of all of that movement of grasping. And to really question, is separation really true? Is it really true? When we speak about awakening, you know, we're not just talking about a little bit of attention. We are actually speaking about rediscovering a quality of limitless freedom in reality that has always been present and is sometimes forgotten. Forgotten in the belief of a separate self. It is like returning to our grandmother's lap. It is that familiar. Awakening through understanding non-separateness, even the idea of two disappears. The idea of there ever being two. It is what the Buddha referred to as suchness. Seeing the suchness of all things. And one of the most wonderful descriptions of this actually comes from a great teacher called Dogen. He said, when all things are seen to exist separately, there is enlightenment and delusion, life and death, Buddhas and ordinary people. When all things are without self, there is no delusion, no enlightenment, no Buddhas, no ordinary people. To start from the self and try to understand all things as delusion, to let the self be awakened by all things is enlightenment. To be enlightened about delusion is to be a Buddha. To study the truth is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be enlightened by all things. Enlightenment is like the moon reflected on the water. The moon doesn't get wet. The water isn't broken. And although its light is vast, the moon is reflected even in a puddle an inch wide. The whole moon and the whole sky are reflected in one dewdrop. Attention has calmness and stillness as its harvest. And stillness has the capacity to listen, to be, to receive, and to welcome as its nature. And receptivity holds the real possibility of being touched by understanding. We have a couple of moments quietly together.